blundered. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Ah, but was it them who really blundered?
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
It was the Manfreds.
The Manfreds.
It was the Manfreds.
Hello and welcome again to the Strange Brew podcast. My name's Jason Barnard and that was Manfred Mann and 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. We've got another Manfreds related podcast here today with Mike Vickers, not only from the band but also a solo artist, composer, arranger and master of many talents. So let's hear what is an absolutely fascinating chat with the great Mike Vickers. Mike, it's a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for agreeing to do this.
Pleasure.
I've recently spoken to Tom McGuinness.
Yeah.
One of the differences with you is that I think you were there at the very, very start of Manfred Mann, weren't you?
Absolutely right. The very, very, very beginning, yeah. I knew Mike Hug. I lived in Southampton when I was in my teens. Mike lived in Gosport, near Portsmouth. So we knew each other locally through local jazz clubs and things like that in Southampton. And then in the same year, Mike worked with Manfred in Butlins in Clapton, I think it was. And I got in touch with Mike when I moved up to London. So we all got together and that was the very, very beginnings of what became Manfred Mann, yeah.
What was your first instrument with Manfred Mann?
The saxophone. That was my main instrument, alto saxophone, when I first came up to London. I played the alto saxophone and the clarinet. And then we all lived in the same flat. I don't know if you've heard about this flat in Forest Hill. In the incredibly cold winter of that year, when there was Manfred and Mike and me and two or three other guys you've probably heard of by now. So that's where it all actually started, yeah. Before Tom, I mean, Tom didn't come in for about a year after that, actually. We had a bass player called Dave Richmond, you've probably heard about.
Yeah, very famous.
Yeah, yeah. And I've been in touch with him lately, which is nice, but he was asked to leave at one point. He won't mind me saying that. And he went into sessions. So I saw him quite a lot in sessions after that, yeah.
One of the key reasons we're here is to talk about hits from the 60s, the relatively new compilation of the Manfred Mann hits, the first Manfred Mann one being 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Yeah.
You released a few singles before that, didn't you? But they didn't chart.
Yeah, the first one was called Why Should We Not? It was instrumental with actually me playing the saxophone along with Paul's harmonica in unison quite a lot. It was a very simple sort of thing. And the second one was called Cock-a-Hoop, which again was a song this time, but it wasn't. Well, I don't think it was even a minor hit, but 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 was the third single we made, and that took off.
The idea being was that Ready, Steady, Go needed a theme tune.
Yeah. We did a South Coast weekly schedule, Southampton, which is essentially my hometown, on a Tuesday at the Concord Club, Wednesday in Bournemouth, I think, and Thursday in Portsmouth, I think. So Paul and, this is very intimate, Paul and Manfred stayed at Mike Hug's parents' house, and Dave stayed with me at my parents' house. So that night, the three of them got together and came up with 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. That's why it was just, I wasn't involved in that.
One of the other aspects of that single is the B-side, Without You, because that's got you quite prominently on, was it flute that you were on?
Flute, yeah. I played the flute as well, I forgot that. I did a solo. There was a guy called Roland Kerr, the black guy who played the tenor saxophone, and he did that singing into the flute business. You play the flute and you sing a lot. And I think I did a solo like that one. It's a bit spitty sound. Remember that?
There's people on the internet talking about that in terms of the lineage to Ian Anderson and Jeff Ruttall.
Yeah, well, I would say Ian Anderson got it from Roland Kerr. I'd definitely say Roland Kerr was the first person I had to do that. Ian Anderson was second, but I think I got there before he did. I'm not quite sure. It wasn't a race or a battle, don't worry.
Just a hunk of steel. Yeah, just a plank of wood. Give a little bit of bad luck. Just a bit of good. I could be so happy with this life of mine, but you know I'm so sad, baby. So sad. Can't find no work. I could have been a good man. Not a good man and not a jerk. Yeah, things could have been different. Could have had some changes made. But you weren't a wait child. Lord knows.
One of the other singles that's on Hits from the 60s is Hubble Bubble, Toil and Trouble. And I think on that one, you did get a songwriting credit.
Yeah, we did that. That's exactly right. That was a sort of a conglomerate thing done with all five contributing to some extent. Yeah. And obviously also it was a kind of follow-up to 5-4-3-2-1 in terms of the rhythms and stuff, which you're not really supposed to do. You know what I mean? It's not long-term advantageous to do the second one like the first one, if you see what I mean. It puts you in a mould. But that's what came out, so there you go.
Bubble Bubble, I think it got to number 11 or something like that.
Did it? Really? Oh, I didn't know.
It was a sizable hit.
Oh, I didn't know that. I didn't know that.
Despite that John Burgess, Tom was saying, that basically pushed you guys into doing cover versions as such, or songs by outside writers.
Well, yeah. That's certainly right. I mean, and there's been recent writings about that from Tom and Paul and others concerned, and Manfred has his own say about that. But it definitely was a source for hit-type songs for the Manfreds, which had already been at least released in America. But we did our own versions, of course. So I honestly just went along with what was happening because I was there. I had other aspirations as well beyond Memphis, but I was happy to be in it, proud to be in it, if you like, enjoyed it. I mean, I added to it with my instrument, saxophone, flute and guitar, which was never any good at, and baritone saxophone, which is also, oh no, not my baby, baritone saxophone as well. So I had the saxophone, flute, baritone saxophone and a bit of guitar, yeah. That was my major role in the band, Jason, at the time.
But that's quite significant because it's not just guitar. That's a range of instruments. And there's a number of tracks in that era when you were with the Manfreds where you could tell you were on it because you had that distinctive sound.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. No, it's very true. I don't want to put myself down at all about all that. It was something that just happened with all of us. I think it just fell into something that worked, you know, which is good.
And to wind it all up this week, Manfred Mann with their latest big success in Britain, Oh No, Not My Baby. Thanks to Manfred Mann.
Huge hits in the States as well in that early period.
Yeah, Do What Diddy was, I think. That was a massive number one hit. Probably all sorts of places around the world. I'm pretty sure it's not only UK and America, but Australia and all the rest of it as well, I think.
What about working with Burt Bacharach for My Little Red Book? He came over to Abbey Road, didn't he?
Forgive me laughing. He's a brilliant musician, brilliant composer. I love his songs. I love the lyrics. Yeah, he came over to do, I mean, you know, there's another connection with George Martin, because I went later on to work with George Martin and Cilla Black, and they'd heard about what happened on Alfie's session with Burt Bacharach. With us, I don't know, me and Paul went along to Burt's. He was working on the movie at the time, I think, and went along to his apartment with Angie Dickinson was there as well, looking after him. And he played us the song, and Paul was there because he was going to sing it, and I was there because I was going to sort of get the musical aspect of it tied up. And then we went into the studio to do it, and there's other stories about how Burt didn't like Manfred's piano playing. I wasn't aware of that at all. But what I was aware of was trying to do that spitty flute thing on the do 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 do. And I wasn't sure if I played it well enough or not. And I was kept on looking up at the control box to see if Burt was smiling or not. And it turned out he was worried about the piano rather than me. But then in the end, it turned up with I don't know if it was the version for the film. Somebody had put a tenor saxophone solo on it instead, so I don't know. Things happen in the recording industry, you know, without you knowing why necessarily.
I just got out my little red book the minute that you said goodbye. Thumbed right through my little red book. I wasn't gonna sit and cry.
and I went from A to Z. I took out every pretty girl in town. They danced with me. While I held them, all I did was to talk about you. Hear your name and I start to cry. There is just no getting over. Girl who's in my little red book just ever could replace your love. And each girl in my little red book knows you're the one I'm thinking of. Won't you please come back to me? Without your precious love I can't go on. Where can you be? I need you so much. All I do is to talk about you. I start to cry. There is just no getting over you. No, no, no. Won't you please come back to me? Without your precious love I can't go on. Where can you be? I need you so much. All I do is to talk about you. Hear your name and I start to cry. There is just no getting over you. No, no. All I do is to talk about you. Hear your name and I start to cry. Well, there is just no getting over you. No, no. All I do is to talk.
There's certain Manfred materials, but what we were saying before was about you could hear your sound, whether it's Stay Around, which I think you wrote, which is a B-side.
Yeah, I did, yeah.
And The Abominable Snowman as well, which...
Yeah.
You hear that, could tell that's distinctive Mike Vickers.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah. No, that was... I liked the title as well on that one, I must say. You know, I think... We were all influenced by certain jazzy things that were going on at the time, but also almost jazzy with a bit of rock and roll, you know, like Cannonball Adderley and all that kind of thing. And so that was probably influenced by that. But that's that one.
Things like that, whether it's an album track or a B-side.
Album track,
you had more freedom than the singles at that time.
Yeah, I suppose you're right. Things sort of seemed to be single orientated from the start and other things. I mean, we did like to put some jazz in, you know. I mean, obviously Tom and Paul were from the blues side and me, Manfred and Mike, very much from the jazz side of things. So we like to put that in. But at the same time, we go flat out on do our diddy, et cetera, when it was required, you know. So it all seemed quite organic to me, you know, because we're a bunch of guys working together, playing together. And what came out, you know, it was quite surprising. I mean, not many bands would have a beautiful vibraphone solo, for example, in the middle. I mean, that was Mike Hug on the vibes, and brilliant. And so I had a lot of talent there. It's good, yeah.
Thank you. John Burgess at the time was a big help in terms of recognising your broader interest and skills, and that led to sort of work on films. And On the Brink itself is one of the great cult singles of that era.
Thank you. Yeah, it's been called a Northern Soul album and the Northern Soul anthem and some other kind of... No, thank you very much. I mean, I was always very fond of that. And I think, if I go back, actually, I'd written that before the Manfreds even started, I think.
Oh.
I have, because I was doing jazz stuff in my hometown of Southampton. I had my own quintet there and all things. And I'm pretty sure we... Anyway, very early on with the Manfreds. And there was some connection with Ready, Steady, Go, but I can't quite remember what, because they did do 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. But I've got a feeling they used that one of mine for a little bit before 5, 2, 1. I'm not certain about that. So John knew I was happy. I had already done a little bit of scoring for Manfreds, a couple of songs, which I put some strings on, arranged strings and stuff. So he knew that I wanted to go into that type of thing. So he agreed to a session for On the Brink, you know, which was my first proper session under my own name. And it had some tricks in it, including speeding up, but it had a big impact. It really did. And quite a few people, I remember George Martin wandering out of the studio when we were doing that. And it led to me working with him a lot later on. And it was a sort of a minor hit, wasn't it, On the Brink?
Yeah.
Became a cult hit, so absolutely certainly. And then that's what led to a film offer for Sandwich Man. The producers had heard that on the radio or something. Yeah, it had quite an impact. Yeah. One guy I worked for in the advertising said, but the first time he heard it, it scared him. Yeah, doing my bit.
What about working with Ron Richards for the Hollies, especially as they moved into what is now known a bit more of the psychedelic era?
Yeah, yeah. I just remember that working with them as being a pleasure, and Ron Richards was very, very nice to me. He seemed to like what I did, and just added some colours and touches and sounds to some of their pieces.
Also from that era is the album that you released, I Wish I Were a Group Again, and your version of Sunshine Superman, which I've loved for years.
Oh, yeah.
Am I right that it's E-By Gum, it's the Sunshine Superman.
Yeah.
It's playful, it's fun.
Yeah.
Do you remember recording that and what you were doing in that?
I do, yeah. And the singers were kind of session singers, and one of them was John Carter, you know, the songwriter, John Carter?
Great songwriter, yeah. He's been on the pod.
Oh, okay. And he was one of the singers on that Sunshine Superman. I just enjoyed it because I thought, well, this is a good idea. Came up with a whole list of other types of man, you know, Super Batman. What was it? Batman.
Beggar Man.
Batman.
Postman. Milkman.
Postman. No. Yeah. E-By Gum. Yeah. I don't know why I did it. Really. I mean, obviously, I wasn't trying to do a cover version of the Donovan song, wasn't it? So I just had fun with it, really.
How did you choose the material that made up that album? Because you had like Cat Stevens, Matthew and Son. You even had Semi-Detached Suburban Mr. James, a Manfred song.
Yeah. Well, I think it was a mixture. It wasn't all done in a day or 2 days or anything. It was stuff that I'd already recorded, put together into an album. And there was a whole bunch of them which were versions of, I think Waterloo Sunset was that one?
Yeah.
Which were sort of current British hits, really.
Right.
Cat Stevens one. On a Carousel, Hollies. Yeah. Did my version of it, that's right.
Dustman, Earthman, Moonman, Spaceman, Snowman, Showman, Batman, Fredman, Batman, Vietnam, White Man, Black Man, Wolfman, Rackman, Yes Man, No Man, Beggar Man, Con Man, Muscle Man, He-Man, She-Man, Shoeman, Shoeman, Old Man, Caveman, Catman, Ant-Man, Tayman, Chessman, Gasman, E-By Goom, it's the Sunshine Superman.
Piece of work that you did in that period is your work on All You Need Is Love.
Yeah.
You know, for many people, working with the Beatles is something massively significant.
Yeah, I have written that, actually. I like my own writing, I must say, and I've done a number of other fiction books, none of which I've managed to get out there, but I have got this one out there on Kindle, just on Kindle eBooks. It's called A Week in the Life, yeah. So it's exactly that, a week of All You Need Is Love, starting from hearing about it because George Martin's father had just died, to the rehearsals, to lots of hassles at home, you know, as we were having. So I do recommend you find it and read it if you're interested, Jason.
You went to, was it Paul McCartney's home to discuss with Paul and John the arrangement?
Yeah, in that's the house he had in St John's Wood. I went around there a few times in the end, actually, because I worked with Mike McGear, and he tended to stay there in London, so I swear a few times. And I put this in my book, how nerve-wracking it was, you know. I'd obviously kind of seen them from a mid-distance here and there, the Beatles, but to actually go upstairs on the top floor and the psychedelic piano was up there, and there they were sitting there, and I don't know how I got through it. I was so nervous. But they just talked about the song, and Paul made sure I got the chords right, and we played along with it a few times. And I think the message to me from George Martin was, write the first thing that comes into your head. So I told that to the Beatles, that George suggested I write the first thing to my head, and they said, that's what we tell him.
I don't think you always get the credit that you have, because there's some sources that just talk about you just conducting the orchestra, the strings players, but you're...
No, there's more than that. But it was a composite effort, so there was a lot more else going on as well. But a week in the life, it'll tell you very clearly about all that. My version, of course, but I was there, you know, I was doing the work, I was writing the notes, I was conducting all this. And that was really, really...
What do you remember of the transatlantic recording? It was all live.
Yeah, you know, it went out. It was live. Well, sort of live. If you want some trade secrets, you could read my book. The All You Need Is Love session, Mick Jagger would say, all sorts of people. You can see at the beginning, Jane Asher, all sorts of people. Early on in the full-length video of it, you can see they pan across the audience, they're sitting there with all their flower power shirts on, you know.
You mentioned Mike McCartney. He seemed to have worked quite a bit with the Scaffold, including Lily the Pink. There was a lot of famous musicians involved, whether they were famous at the time or not. There was Elton John, Graham Nash, wasn't there, and Tim Rice?
It was session musicians mostly.
Right.
When Jack Bruce came in, with the original was, I forget who the bass player was, Clem Cattini. You must have heard of Clem Cattini by now.
Yeah, he's been on.
Oh, good. He's a lovely guy. He was on the drums and blah, blah, blah. And Mike took it away and he said, well, we need another session. And they put some more bass on it. And I couldn't quite understand why. And something else he wanted. So it was the second session. And that's when Jack Bruce was called in. And the reason Mike called Jack Bruce, because he thought I knew Jack Bruce, because Jack took over, you know, when I left and what I called chapter one and a half, when I went and Paul stayed and Jack came in, plus Henry Lowther and Lynn Dobson. So, but I didn't really know Jack. I met him a couple of times, but that's why he was there. But it was a sing-along, you know.
Yeah.
Not much else you could say about it. But again, it's a huge hit.
It wasn't just Lily the Pink that you worked on with the Scaffold.
Yeah, I did quite a few sessions with them. Let me see if I can remember. Do You Remember? Do you remember that one? Do You Remember? And my first wife sang the little, at the beginning, yeah. She's not with us anymore, but she did that bit. Just because she was in the studio with me and thought, hang on, this is a good idea. And I did quite a few sessions with them. I can't remember. But I also did a tour with them.
Oh.
And I was MD on a tour with them and the Hollies and with Paul Jones. Did you know about that?
No.
Ooh.
That must have been great fun.
Ooh.
UK tour, I assume.
Yeah. It was, I think it was. And I had an orchestra there. So we did an opening tune with my orchestra, which nobody ever got, you know. I had them stamp, it was called Stamp Collector, and I had the band stamping on the floor in time, you see, and the audience didn't quite get it. Really. And then Paul and then the Scaffold all the other way around, and the Hollies in the second half, you know, so that was the whole tour. But they were quite fun to work with, those guys. They're pretty clever and a bit cheeky with it.
We'll drink a drink a drink to Lily the Pink, the Pink, the Pink, the savior of the human race. For she invented medicinal compound, most efficacious in every case.
Mr. Fleas had sticky out ears, and so they gave him medicinal compound, and now he's learning how to fly. Brother Tony was known to be bony, he would never eat his meals, and so they gave him medicinal compound, and now they move him round on wheels.
Savior of the human race, for she invented medicinal compound, most efficacious in every case.
Old Ebenezer thought he was Julius Caesar, and so they put him in a home, where they gave him medicinal compound, and now he's a
medicinal compound. Now we see, never heard.
We'll drink a drink a drink to Lily the Pink, the Pink, the Pink, the savior of the human race. For she invented medicinal compound, most efficacious in every case.
Auntie Millie ran willy nilly when her legs they medicinal compound, now they call her Millie B.
Jennifer Eccles had terrible freckles, and the boys all called her names, but she changed with medicinal compound, now he joins in all the games.
Despite a medicinal compound, sadly Pickle Lily died.
Up to heaven her soul ascended, all the church bells they did ring. She took with her medicinal
to it earlier of working with George Martin,
yeah,
with Cilla Black. When was the first time you started speaking with George and getting more involved with him?
Well, I would say before All You Need Is Love, because that's why he asked me. You know, his dad had died and he felt he couldn't, he could be there for the sessions, but he couldn't be there for the preliminary things and also doing the arrangements. So that's why he asked me, because I'd already worked with him. Now, I don't think that was with Cilla. Cilla was a bit later, I think. But that's where it came from, you know, and she seemed to like what it did, and it went on for, I think, about 4 years. I mean, it's a massive...
Step Inside Love was one of the first, and that was obviously another Beatle connection, given that's yeah. Paul's song. Was he involved at all?
Yeah, yeah, he came along. That's after I'd already done some for Cilla, so it's different to the All You Need Is Love. And... she also was doing her TV show, and I ended up doing quite a number of arrangements for her TV show, which maybe later we recorded it or not. And the same with Cliff Richard as well. So I was working for them both at one time. So I went along to heard that Paul had written her a song for a new upcoming series. So that's when I met, saw him and said, and we talked about the arrangement. And we and the point of it then was to just do an arrangement for the TV series for our opening song, which I did.
It was released a bit later, wasn't it? A TV series was 67 and then the actual single was the following year.
Was it? No, I don't. Yeah, that's good. I'm not really aware of the dates and all that, but it's just approximately. Yes, so it worked on the TV show and Paul was there too and he seemed happy with it. And so then the decision was made was separately to go to a studio and do it properly for a her recording. Paul came along to that as well, and it didn't it didn't work. For some reason or other, it just didn't gel, you know, which is very rare in the studio. If you great musicians, there's always in studios and things usually, but for some reason it didn't. And later I realised the first time I'd heard it, Paul was playing the guitar, not the bass guitar, the guitar himself. And he really does play very beautifully. He plays everything he plays beautifully. He's an amazing natural musician, that guy. And it was the sound of him that worked with Silla's voice rather than the guitar player, not being disparaging about it, I even forget who it was, but it just didn't work. So we called for another session and... still Paul didn't do it, but another player, another session player played it and it worked fine, yeah. So doesn't often happen that we do this to it again, doesn't often happen.
Step inside, love. Let me find you a place where the cares of the day will be carried away by the smile on your face. We are together now and forever. Come my way, step inside, love, and stay. Step inside, love. Step inside, love. Step inside, love. I want you to stay. You look tired, love. Let me turn down the light. Coming out of the cold, rest your head on my shoulder and love me tonight. I'll always be here if you should need me. Night and day, step in. When you leave me, say you'll see me again. For I know in my heart you will not be apart, and I'll miss you till then. We'll be together now and forever. Come my way, step inside, love, and stay. Step inside.
This is a song that you wrote, the B-side of Something Tells Me. La 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 loo. That was more conventional, though.
Well, that was my song for the Please Sir movie. And I said to the producers that I wanted to ask her if she'd do it. So they were very pleased about that. And she did it as a favour, to be honest with you. She wasn't paid very much. And Bobby made sure that I knew that. And I wasn't, but they were doing it because we had a good sort of... And my ex-wife, Sue wrote a song for Silla. It's called Easy in Your Company. I don't know if you heard of that one at all. It's another title song for a series. I don't know if it came out. So there was quite a nice connection there, you know, so that's why it worked out.
The Silla Black material, even though you've got that commercial edge, some of the songs were more challenging. You've got Follow the Path of the Stars, which was a Skip Bifferty song, which was very jazzy at times.
Yeah. I seem to remember that was one of the earliest ones I did with Silla, actually. Did they have a harpsichord on it or something like that?
Yeah, yes.
Yeah, I think that was one of the first sessions I did with her, actually, yeah.
It changes tempo, the jazzier elements.
Yeah, I'll have to play it now. I've got the whole collection somebody put together a whole collection of Scylla's stuff, or her EMI years, all of it. So all of the stuff I did. But it certainly, I was happy with that. But she seemed to like me. I got on with her and Bobby very well. They were so friendly, and George seemed to like what I was doing, and that. So it worked very well. But then it stopped. You know, it's the part of the business, really. I think she went off to another label at that point.
The stars have said our love's untrue, and just because we shared a life, there is no reason for a soul to die. The kind who care, and not the sort like me you found, we're mean and hard and we push around.
Do you remember working with Wayne Bickerton for World of Oz?
Yes, with World of Oz.
This song's like The Muffin Man, which is a cult.
Is it?
A cult song.
The Muffin.
That's it.
Yeah, I remember it. I did a session with him with Kenny Everett, I remember. He was Wayne as a producer, yeah.
What about Francois Hardy?
Oh, yeah.
Did you go over to France to work with her?
No, she came over here. We did that at Olympic. Serge Gainsbourg was at the session. And also Jane Birkin was at the session. Do you know these names?
Well, Je T'aime.
Yeah, that's it. Exactly. They were both there, as well as Françoise. And it was so I don't know.
What about you getting involved with the Moog synthesizer? Because you're a pioneer in this space. And there's some fantastic footage of yourself on Tomorrow's World demonstrating it.
I know. It's a long time ago now. Before colour TV, before the internet.
The kit must have cost a king's ransom at the time, and it was pioneering stuff.
Well, thank you. I'd always loved electronic music anyway from when I was in my teens. I didn't grow up in my teens loving popular music at all. I listened to a load of jazz and some very early electronic music from Stockhausen and people like that. So I was always interested. Then time went by and I just read somewhere in the music paper that there was this crazy guy in New York State called Robert Moog, who had invented a synthesizer. And I immediately thought, God, I've got to follow this up, you know. And I just happened to meet a couple of guys who worked at AdVision Studios. And it turned out they were agents for the import of this device. I almost immediately ordered one. It was expensive, yeah. I mean, for the time it was. But I just wanted it. That's all I knew. I didn't know what I wanted to do with it.
Were you responsible for introducing that to George Harrison and the Beatles?
No, because I think they've heard it it was a race in the end, because obviously other people would pick up this news about the synthesizer, and around the same time, down mine arrived. I think George got his first, and then mine arrived, and I had it in my flat in Baker Street, and I was spent a lot of time with George Martin at the time. I said, "Oh, do you want to come around and see my Moog?" Because I was showing off. They hadn't got this yet, you know. So he came around with Giles in his arms.
Oh, right. It was a small child,
yes.
A baby, or
head lolling about, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So that was it. Yeah. So, but I just loved it, and I did the synthesizer, and I did quite a lot of lively music because people were very interested in the kind of new sounds aspect of it. And half of the ones I did were sort of really way out and far out and experimental and weird, and the other half were very sort of corny almost, you know, because you can make the Moog do type of sounds, you know what I mean? So, yeah, I mean, no time everybody was using synthesizers, and it was partly me, I think, that brought it to people's attention.
There's a line that says that you helped teach the Beatles how to use the Moog during recording sessions for Abbey Road. Is that completely fictitious?
No, it's partly true.
Oh.
It's quite a lot true, actually. I mean, again, I had a call from George Martin, and said they were wanting to use the synthesizer on some songs, and could I come along and set it up? Because although in the end it was George's one that was used in the Abbey Road sessions, there's photos to show. But he could do a number of things with it, but I was able to kind of try and conjure up sounds which the other guys seemed to want for their songs. So in the end, what happened is I plugged the sounds up, and then whoever wrote the song would play the keyboard, play the whatever they wanted to play on the keyboard, but I'd be just programming the sounds. So I didn't really teach them how to play, but I certainly plugged it up for all the sounds on Abbey Road, yeah.
Here Comes the Sun.
Yeah.
In particular, that's one of the most played songs now in the streaming era of all time.
Really, is that right? Yeah.
All these instrumental sounds were made electronically by one man, Michael Vickers, on a single musical instrument. It's called the Moog synthesizer. It produces sounds in a matter of minutes, which would normally take radiophonic experts with their complicated equipment days of work and multiple re-recording to achieve. The instrument is made up of independent electronic units packed together into a compact console. There are oscillators which produce the sound, filters, amplifiers, and envelope generators which shape it. The sound can even be automatically triggered. You don't have to be an electronics expert to play the Moog. All you need is a good musical ear, because you create your sound simply by plugging into the right holes. When you've done this, they can be played on the keyboard. The keyboard range can be altered so that notes never heard before on a piano can now be produced. As well as short notes, long continuous sounds can be played on the second keyboard by running a finger up and down a stretched metal band. This produces continuously changing voltages, which in turn produce changing sounds. The instrument is called a synthesizer because the sound of any musical instrument can be built up electronically. A composer need no longer bother with a room full of tape recorders and electronic equipment. His time can be devoted entirely to producing the music he wants to play. But once you've finished plugging up the oscillators, you can play from an ordinary score. The days of the one-man band are back again.
The 70s saw you heavily involved in library music and music for specific films.
Well, that's where I wanted to go. I think I did okay. I mean, some of the early stuff was for movies, which are comedies, which weren't terrifically funny, really, in my opinion. You know what I mean?
Some of the comedies in that era have dated.
Well, I would say, yeah. I mean, Sandwich Man, that was the first one I did, Press for Time. Normal Wisdom film, but it was a good experience. But I just seemed to get comedy ones. And then Please Sir came along, another sort of comedy one. But then I did Dracula one, which was a different matter entirely. So I think that one stands up pretty well with the music, actually, the Dracula AD 72 one. And then I did At the Earth's Core in the 70s, which was sort of a lot of electronic in that. And then the last movie I did was Warlords of Atlantis, which was fairly big orchestra. And that's probably the best one I did, actually.
Visitation, that's huge in Poland, isn't it?
Oh, that one. Yeah, I know the one you mean. Yeah. I know. It's like a rocket taking off, isn't it?
I mean, that's one of the great things about library music is you don't necessarily know where your music's going to be featured.
No, absolutely right. Absolutely right. But I was pleased to hear, you know, if anybody's picked up on anything, mine, I was always pleased to hear it. But mostly what I did was all the arranging stuff was largely anonymous, you know, and people in the business knew, but it wasn't, whatever. I mean, it's a fantastic experience. The arranging was a fantastic experience, an amazing apprenticeship. And I got to work with many different people in many different styles. So it was actually really good for me.
What led you back to playing with the Manfreds in the 90s?
Well, I suppose by the 90s, in fact, we did it was Tom's kind of anniversary. He devised a concert because it was his 40th or 50th or something like that. And they were part of the blues band there, and part of the blues band, part of McGinnis Flint and part of Manfred, so they were all there. So from that came the idea to, because the Manfred thing seemed to go well, to go on the road with it at some point and see how it did. And it grew from that to be by no means full-time, but certainly busy. And I had no idea that that was going to happen. I just happened to have bought another saxophone about a year before, coincidentally, and didn't play the guitar. So in the new Manfred, and I got a flute, so... It just was something else for me. I'm not talking about anybody else. Obviously, the others have been touring pretty much all the time in between, but I hadn't. And it was all novel to me going back on the road and actually staying in proper hotels. Wow, things are looking up. So it was, and we traveled. We went to Australia, you know, a couple of times, and we went to where I met my second wife, Connie, who's downstairs.
And then in the last couple of decades, you've gone back and released some of your own solo work. There's the complete soprano sessions. And there's also a video on YouTube of where not only is one of your pieces of music, you've done a whole...
animation.
Cool and Hot.
Cool and Hot. Oh, listen, it's lovely talking to you because you've obviously done a lot of research. You may know more than I did almost. Yeah, I mean, I was with the Manfreds in the 90s and then at the end of the 90s, I felt like I had so many other things I wanted to do, creatively speaking. Since then, I've been working from home, doing some of the things you mentioned, and lots of other things, and lots of stuff that haven't come out. I've done quite a lot of writing and written 6 fiction books, so I've done all sorts of things. Cool and Hot was a software called Blender. I don't know if you've heard of it. It's 3D animation software.
Yeah.
And that was one of the Soprano Sessions tracks. Yeah, and I thought, well, I'll have a go animating this. It took me 8 months to do just that. I think it's about 4 minutes or something. And it's by no means state of the art at all, but at least what you see fits the music and vice versa. So I was very pleased with that.
Is that what we've got to look forward to? Hopefully some books to come out and maybe some new music?
Well, that's what I'm working on all the time. But Yeah, I've been a long time now. It's been like over 20 years now since I left Memphis and didn't have that kind of work gig. And I've been very, very, very happily getting on with my own stuff. But getting it out there seems to be something else again. I haven't retired, though. Haven't retired. No way. I'm not going to retire. That's the way to madness. It's amazing to talk to somebody who knows so much. It's extraordinary.
Well, I have to say, Mike, it's been a joy to talk to you because not only have we got the early Manfred stuff, but the material and collaborations that you did in the 60s and 70s in particular, yeah, it's a huge pleasure. So thank you.
Thank you very much for saying that. And it's been a pleasure talking to you, Chase. Thanks very much, Julia. You take care. Thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Strange Brew podcast. If you do like the show, please consider a small donation to help keep the show archive online. It's 10 years since I started the podcast and hosting fees are increasing over time. All your support keeps the show running and helps me get amazing guests. To support me, just go to thestrangebrew.co.uk where you'll see a donate button on the homepage. Thank you very much. Plus, any reviews on your podcast services help to spread the word too. Thank you.